very happy and honored to introduce Professor Barbara Coleridge, and I think we're all honored to have her and her husband come here to be with us and to present for us. I was myself fortunate to meet Barbara first in 1996 as an undergraduate at the University of California in Santa Barbara, where Professor Coleridge is professor of, guess what, religious studies in the Department of Religious Studies, which is the largest department west of the Mississippi River in America. It's a very prominent department, and she is in developing the South Asian studies aspect of this department over these many years, indeed. She's helping me out with a bit of overview of the many different projects that we have. There's three types of projects, so just you can get some idea. One general project, which is, I guess, mainly how I encountered her through a course. I was her student in a course on comparative religion, what she calls the politics of comparison. And I will quote here her, the first sentence. "My work as a comparative historian of religions has emphasized the role of comparative study, and in particular the comparative study of Hinduism and Judaism, as a method of critical interrogation that can serve as a means to dismantle the tyranny of the dominant paradigms of academy, and to explore a range of alternative epistemologies." For some of you, this was a mouthful of terms, which
I won't be using those terms today.
Don't worry, you won't get too much of that. but the first book in this context, which I first obtained at the California bookstore, which she has written, called Veda and Torah, Transcending the Textuality of Scripture, the fascinating exploration of Veda and Torah, the Jewish tradition of Scripture, and how one might relate these, especially in terms of their cosmologies. And she's also co-edited, or is co-editing, Beyond Huber and Maus, Reimagining Sacrifice in Hindu and Jewish Traditions, which is a collection of essays providing a critical assessment of prevailing theories of sacrifice in the academy. This is a big topic in religious studies, what is sacrifice. The next major theme project is Hindu discourses of the body in the humanities in general, in philosophy, in anthropology, in sociology. There's a lot of talk about the body. And so Professor Coleridge, Barbara, is contributing very much to this, especially with her idea of embodied communities, which I can say I have made use of in my own doctoral thesis, embodied communities versus missionizing communities or institutions. With respect to this project, she has three works, two forthcoming volumes. One is her own book, Bhakti and Embodiment, Fashioning Divine Bodies and Devotional Bodies in Krishna Bhakti. And then she's co-editing a volume called Refiguring the Body, Embodiment in South Asian Religions. She's also working on a third volume, The Body and the Self, Hindu Contributions to Theories of Embodiment. And by the way, she's also contributing an article to a book, which I am co-editing, on the Bhagavata Purana, on the topic of the Dhamma, as she prefers the expression Dhamma to what's more familiar to most of you, Dhamma, She likes to use the uninflected form.
The stem form.
The stem form. So we'll hear some of that.
Oh, I forgot that. That's
all right.
Okay.
They're used to Goswami and Yogi instead of
Goswami. You'll hear all the ends from me. Yeah.
You'll hear that. And then the third category of her work, which is I'm still eager to see some of it, is regarding sacred spaces and cultural landscapes in South Asia. She's specifically been focusing on Braja. And there is coming any day now, perhaps, a geospatial multimedia digital volume from geographic place to transcendent space, tracking Krishna's footprints in Braja Mandal. Wow, this is going to be exciting. Which she intends to publish as soon as she gets copyright clearance.
It's a long process.
The volume focuses on Braja Mandala, the region of Braja in North India, that is celebrated as the abode, the dhamma, of the deity Krishna. Today she's going to talk to with us, she's going to read, as is her preference, a paper on the subject of, what's your title? Meditation as Devotional Practice and Jiva Goswami's Philosophy of Education. Barbara, thank you very much. Please welcome Barbara.
Well, it's a great delight to be here. And when I stepped out after trying to recuperating from a long trip, I really do feel that Villa Vrindavana partakes of the madhurya, the sweetness of the mula, of the root, Vrindavana in India. I mean, it really is a very special place, and I'm delighted to be here. And I know many of the scholars that have been involved in the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. I've had the pleasure of working with many of them at UCSB, and it's just a great delight to finally be among all of you in such a wonderful setting. So, and I am doing the academic thing. I didn't realize that, I mean, I could have done a more informal paper, but this will be, you'll get a taste of the boring academic style here, but I'm going to be talking about, I'm starting with this idea of philosophy of education as a kind of entry point to think about how Jiva Goswami, I will use the stem forms, Jiva Goswami in the Krishna Sandarbha and the Bhakti Sandarbha, how he focuses on basically the role and interrelationship of external bodily practices and internal meditative practices and their respective roles in the training of the sadhaka, and particularly in the advanced phases of Raghunuga Bhakti. So I was taking that theme of education and how does one train the sadhaka, and I've been very immersed in the Krishna Sandarbha in the book that you mentioned, Bhakti and Embodiment. It really is mostly about Bhagavata Purana and then the Gaudiya interpretation, and so I'm very interested in the Goswamins and Krishna Sandarbha particularly. So as I was immersed in that, I encountered a lot of ideas about meditation. And I know through my contacts with a lot of devotees at ISKCON that there's a question about what is role of meditation, role of reflection as opposed to chanting and so on. And I was really struck at how profound emphasis there is in the Krishna Sandarbha on meditation. But again, it's an advanced stage of practice, so I thought that might be interesting to bring this out as part of this discussion about education. And in this case, education as training of the sadhaka. So what I'm going to focus on more specifically, kind of as an entry point into thinking about these issues, is the way in which Jiva Goswami talks about Vraja Dhaman, Krishna's abode, in the Krishna Sandarbha. And there he maintains that while the earthly Vraja can be engaged with material senses, right, through bodily practices such as pilgrimage, the transcendent Vraja Dhaman, Goloka Vrindavana, is beyond the material senses and can only be apprehended through direct experience, the term anubhava, direct experience. Although Goloka Vrindavana is not visible to the material eye, it can be seen through direct visionary experience. And Jiva invokes the authority of Vyasa and the other great rishis or seers, who while immersed in samadhi beyond the material realm of Prakriti, in the depths of meditation, attained a direct cognition of Gopala Krishna in his transcendent Vraja Dhaman. And then they recorded their cognitions in the Shastras.
He declares the direct experiences of the sages to be what he calls the crest jewel of all pramanas, and that the records of their experiences that are preserved in the shastras, he says, are the most authoritative testimonies of valid knowledge for all generations, past, present, and future. And he also claims that these experiences are not the exclusive prerogative of the sages of the past. But he says multiple times, and I thought it was an interesting expression, he said these experiences can be attained even today by advanced practitioners of Raga Nuga Bhakti who incorporate meditation into their regimen of Sadhana Bhakti as a form of devotional practice. So Jiva then allots a pivotal role to various kinds of meditative practices as a critical component of the Gaudiya path of sadhana bhakti, and more specifically, Raga Nuga Bhakti. And he says they can serve as means to attain, again, this direct experiential realization of Krishna's absolute body, what he calls the vigraha, and also his unmanifest lila in the transcendent Vrajadhaman. Jiva declares one should engage in bhakti yoga in the form of meditation, and the term there he uses is dhyana. And he deploys a number of strategies to distinguish the Gaudiya meditative practices that are integral to bhakti yoga from the meditation techniques advocated by yoga and tantric traditions. And I found this really to be really important, and I know this is an issue in a certain way. I think that meditation has maybe been viewed with suspicion because of its associations with yoga and tantra. And I found that he was very conscious of trying to distinguish the kinds of practices he was advocating, in some ways overlapping with these earlier traditions, but at the same time very clear on how does one reorient practices as devotional practices. So in the Krishna Sandarbha and Bhakti Sandarbha, Jiva discusses a range of meditative practices, and he uses various terms. I'll just mention them. Smarana, contemplative recollection. Dhyana, meditation. Bhavana, or chintana, usually translated as contemplation. And then mantropasana, which is meditation by means of a mantra on a particular lila. And I'll come back to that one a little bit later, that particular practice. So I want to start with smarana and dhyana as fundamental practices. Now, in Jiva's representations of meditative practices, he builds on the formulations of Rupa Goswami in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And Rupa himself, I'm not going to talk about Rupa's conceptions here, but I'll briefly mention, and many of you may be familiar with his terms here, but Rupa includes jhana, meditation on the Lord, and smriti, remembering the Lord, among the 64 practices of Vaidhi Bhakti. And he also allots a significant role to smarana, contemplative recollection, in its discussion of the advanced practices of Raga Nuga Bhakti. And there's a particular statement that Rupa makes in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that provides the basis for the meditative practice of smarana as it's elaborated on by Jiva and then later Gaudiya authorities such as Krishnadas Kaviraja. So let me read this statement from Rupa. It says, one should dwell continually in Vraja, absorbed in various stories about it, remembering Krishna and his beloved associates whose devotional mode accords with one's own. One who wishes to realize a particular devotional mode, bhava, should perform devotional service, emulating the resonance of Raja with both the sadhaka rupa, practitioner's body, and the siddha rupa, perfected body. Now, in his commentary, Jiva maintains that these verses encapsulate the central method of Raga Nuga Bhakti. And he suggests that this method ideally involves dwelling in Vraja with both the physical body and the mind. And he says, even if the Raga Nuga Sadaka is not able to live physically in Vraja, then he or she should dwell there continually through the practice of smarana, contemplative recollection. This practice involves emulating an eternal associate of Vraja, whose devotional mode accords with the sadhaka's own inherent nature, with both the sadhaka rupa and the siddha rupa. And Jiva glosses sadhaka rupa as the body as it is. And siddha rupa, he calls an internal meditative body that is suitable for one's intended devotional service to Krishna. Jiva's understanding of Raga Nuga Bhakti centers then on this meditative practice of smarana, which entails constructing a meditative body through which the sadhaka can dwell mentally in Vraja even when residing outside of the Dhamma. And I'll return to this notion of the meditative body a bit later. Now, in the Bhakti Sandarbha, Jiva provides an extended analysis of smarana, in which he defines smarana as contemplative recollection of the namans, names, rupas, forms, gunas, qualities, parikaras, eternal associates, seva, service, and lilas, playful activities of Krishna. His analysis of smarana distinguishes five stages. First, smarana, thinking about Krishna in any manner. Second, dharana, withdrawal of the attention from external sense objects and focusing the mind on Krishna. Third, dhyana, meditation on the forms of Krishna and his other aspects. Fourth, dhruva anusriti, a more advanced stage of meditation in which the consciousness is supposed to flow towards Krishna in an unbroken stream. And then fifth, samadhi, the most advanced stage of meditation, in which the sadhaka attains a state of complete absorption, in which the object of meditation, Krishna, Swayam Bhagavan, shines forth. Now, in his analysis of the five-stage meditative practice of smarana, then, what is Jiva doing? He's actually, it's interesting, he's appropriating and recasting three terms that are central to the practice of yogic meditation in Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga, the eight-limbed program of yoga. Three terms that Patanjali uses are dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. These three terms are incorporated into this fivefold schema of smarana by Jiva. But what we see already happening is that Jiva is recasting these terms and embedding them in a devotional framework focused on realization of Krishna. And he explicitly, he's very conscious of this, he explicitly distinguishes his understanding of samadhi from the yogic notion of asampragnata samadhi. And here's how he distinguishes. He says, whereas the yogin attains an objectless state of absorption in the lowest aspect of the Godhead, nirvishesha brahman, which is impersonal and formless, the bhakta attains a state of absorption in the highest aspect of the Godhead, Bhagavan, who is personal and possessed of a luminous absolute body. So he wants to keep the term samadhi, but he always is reframing it and making very clear how this is distinct from other uses of the term. In the case of those yogins who take up the path of bhakti as adherents of Shantarasa, who are focused on experience of Krishna as an object of meditation, but do not seek an ultimate emotional relationship with him, Jiva maintains that they do not attain, the adherents of Shantarasa, do not attain the highest form of samadhi, but rather they experience the intermediary form of the Godhead, Paramatman, in which Krishna appears in his four-armed form as Vishnu, the antaryaman, or inner controller within the heart. The highest state of samadhi is attained only by advanced practitioners of Raganuga Bhakti who seek to realize a passionate, loving relationship with Krishna by cultivating one of the four principal rasas, devotional modes, that are embodied by the eternally perfected associates who reside with Krishna in the transcendent Vrajadhaman. I'm sure most of you are familiar with these, but let me just mention them. The Dasi Rasa, the mode of service exemplified by the attendants of Krishna. Sakya Rasa, the mode of friendship exemplified by the Gopas. Vatsalya Rasa, the mode of parental love exemplified by Nanda and Yashoda and other elders. And then Madhurya Rasa, the mode of erotic love exemplified by the Gopis. Now, Jiva's comments on the role of meditation in Raganuga Bhakti suggests that the Raganuga Sadhaka's experience of samadhi surpasses that of the adherent of Shantarasa, the more meditative form of bhakti, in three ways. He says, first, the form that manifests in the Raganuga Sadhaka's experience of samadhi is not Krishna's four-armed antaryaman form as Paramatman, but rather his two-armed Gopamurti, right, his cowherd form, that is the Svayam Rupa, the essential form of his absolute body, the absolute body of Bhagavan. Second, the Raganuga Sadhaka's experience of samadhi differs from that of the Shanta Bhakta, not only in terms of the specific form of Krishna that manifests, but also the locus of that form. The Raganuga Sadhaka penetrates beyond the experience of Krishna's rupa seated in the lotus of the heart and awakens to the luminous Gopamurti of his absolute body, enthroned in the Yogapita of the lotus of Goloka Vrindavana, the transcendent Vrajadhaman. So the distinction between Krishna seated in the heart and Krishna seated in the Dhamma is really important, and I'll come back to that as I think one of the most distinctive aspects of this meditative practice, of the meditative practices that Jiva advocates. Third, the manifestation of Krishna that unfolds in this samadhi of the Raga Nugasarika includes not only the Vigraha, Krishna's absolute body, and his Dhamman, which is represented as an extension of the absolute body, but also his lila, and more specifically his aprakrita lila, unmanifest lila in Goloka Vrindavana. He says very explicitly that the Shanta Bhakta will not attain a cognition of the lila, even if he can attain or she can attain experience of Krishna in the heart as the four-armed Vishnu. He will not or she will not attain the lila, the experience of the lila. In his discussions of Smarana and Dhyana, Jiva ultimately establishes a hierarchy of religious experience, in which among the various rupas, dhamans, lilas, and parikaras, or associates of Krishna, that the Raga Nugasarika might seek to realize, he singles out a highly particularized experience of samadhi as the culmination of meditative practice. The experience of the Gopamurti, of Krishna's absolute body, in his supreme dhaman, Goloka Vrindavana, engaged in the Goloka Lila, that is characterized by madhurya, pure sweetness, with the gopas and gopis as his parikaras, or associates. Jiva asserts that pure Raghunuga Bhakti is found only in Goloka Vrindavana and not in any other dhaman. And he celebrates the glories of meditation on Krishna, Purna Bhagavan, as Vrajendra Nandana, the son of Nanda, the lord of Raja, in the Goloka Lila. Among the various playful activities in the Goloka Lila, he extols in particular meditation on Krishna's love play with the gopis in the Rasa Lila, which is the Rahasa Lila, the most recondite of Lilas, and which is surpassed in greatness only by his love play with Radha, the most beloved of the gopis. Now, with respect to the specific types of meditative practices that are advocated by Jiva, he suggests that this practice of smarana, as I mentioned earlier, involves contemplative recollection of Krishna's namans, rupas, parikaras, and lilas. So these can all be used in principle as vehicles of meditation. The implication of his analysis is that irrespective of which of these elements is adopted as a vehicle in meditation, it's meditation on, this is my argument now, that it's meditation on Krishna in his dhaman that is the most critical component that gives the Raga Nugasarika's meditative practice a unique character that distinguishes it from other types of meditation techniques advocated by yogic or tantric traditions. In his discussions of meditation, Jiva mentions a number of different techniques that are distinguished primarily by the specific type of meditation device that is used as a vehicle for transcending, whether it's Krishna's namans, rupas, parikaras, or lilas. The namans that are used, or the names that are used as vehicles of meditation, are mantras that incorporate various names of Krishna. The rupas include iconic forms, such as Krishna's Gopamurti, as well as aniconic yantras that serve as meditation devices. The parikaras are the eternal associates of Raja with whom sadhakas seek to identify in meditation. And the lilas are the particular lila activities that provide a focal point for different meditation sessions. In the course of elaborating on these various meditation techniques, Jiva refers to devices and practices that are often associated with tantric ritual traditions, and I'll come back to these in a minute, but let me just mention a few of them right now. So he's talking about mantras, which of course are not totally the Vedic tradition. Mantras, mandalas, yantras, bhuta shuddhi, nyasa, manasa puja, mudras. These are terms that are often associated with tantric ritual practices, and I'll come back and talk about how these are incorporated into particular schema by Jiva a little bit later. And we'll see that when we come back to these, that at each point, again, that Jiva's concerned to invest these devices and practices with distinctively Gaudiya valences by re-inscribing them as forms of sadhana bhakti that are aimed at constituting a perfected devotional body, as distinct from a tantric form of sadhana that's aimed at constructing a divinized tantric body. He's very concerned to make this distinction, as we'll see. Ajiva advocates, in terms of types of meditation, I want to move to mantra meditation and the relationship between mantra meditation and mandala visualization. So Ajiva advocates mantra dhyana, meditation utilizing mantras that describe the status of sound embodiments of Krishna. And he sees this as one of the most efficacious means of realizing the Supreme Godhead in his transcendent dharma. Mantra meditation, as represented by Jiva, is often accompanied by visualization techniques and bodily practices through which the sadhaka engages with the mind, speech, senses, and other faculties, various aspects of Krishna, and thereby gradually transforms the sadhaka rupa, the material psychophysical complex, culminating in the realization of a siddha rupa, a perfected non-material devotional body that is suffused with the qualities and substance of the absolute body of Bhagavan. Among the mantras that are recognized, that are recommended for use as vehicles of meditation, Jiva extols in particular the efficacy of the 18-syllable mantra, Klim Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana Vallabhaya Svaha, which he celebrates as the Maha Mantra that is the king of mantras and that embodies Krishna's Svarupa, essential form. Jiva discusses the 18-syllable mantra in the Krishna Sandarbha and also in the Dig Darshini Tika, his commentary in the Brahma Samhita. And in both the Krishna Sandarbha and the Dig Darshini Tika, he's commenting on the Brahma Samhita's representations, particularly of Goloka Vrindavana as a thousand-petal lotus mandala. The Brahma Samhita portrays Goloka as a thousand-petal lotus that is encompassed by a quadrangle called Shveta Dvipa. The text identifies Krishna's daman with the pericarp, or the seed vessel, the center of the lotus, which it depicts as a hexagonal yantra with six points. In his commentaries on the Brahma Samhita's portrayal of the lotus mandala, Jiva locates the six parts of the 18-syllable mantra in the six corners of the hexagonal yantra that is the pericarp of the lotus. And he asserts, moreover, that the varna sounds of the mantra are non-different from Krishna's svarupa. Now, in order to provide canonical authority to ground his claim regarding the special status of the 18-syllable mantra, Jiva invokes the Gopala Tapani Upanishad, which provides an extended exposition of the 18-syllable mantra as the quintessential sound embodiment of Krishna, in which it divides the mantra into five parts rather than six. And the Upanishad says, just as the wind enters into the world and assumes five forms in each body as the five breaths, in the same way Krishna, although one, manifests as sound in five parts for the welfare of the world. According to another verse from the Gopala Tapani Upanishad that is repeatedly invoked by Jiva, this fivefold mantra, comprising 18 syllables, is the sonic counterpart of the fivefold vigraha, absolute body of Krishna, that consists of Sat Chit Ananda, being consciousness and bliss. So here's the key verse. I, along with the Maruts, constantly seek to please with the most excellent hymn of praise, the one and only Govinda, whose fivefold vigraha, absolute body, consists of Sat Chit Ananda, and who sits seated beneath a Devadaru tree in Vrindavana. The focus here is again that fivefold. And I always wondered when I first encountered why fivefold, and then I realized it's because of this fivefold, the five parts of the 18-syllable mantra. Jiva also invokes another verse from the Gopala Tapani Upanishad that describes how the Brahma, the creator, meditated with the 18-syllable mantra, after which Krishna appeared before his eyes in the garb of a gopa. In the same way, Jiva suggests, those who mentally repeat this mantra that is the sound correlate of Krishna's vigraha will see the absolute body of Gopala Krishna in the form and garb of a cowherd, attaining a direct visionary experience of Bhagavan comparable to the cognitions obtained by Brahma the creator and Vyasa, the acclaimed rishi of rishis. Although he does not explicitly discuss its role in meditation, the implication of Jiva's analysis of the lotus mandala with a hexagonal yantra in its center is that it is used together with the 18-syllable mantra inscribed on the yantra as a meditation device that involves activating both the auditory and visual modes of perception, culminating in a synesthetic experience in samadhi of the unmanifest structures of Krishna's Dhamman that transcends the material senses and activates the non-material senses. Although Jiva leaves out of his analysis the specific instructions for this particular meditation, I would suggest, based on his discussions elsewhere, that the meditation involves mentally vocalizing the divine names contained in the mantra in sequence, while simultaneously visualizing the corresponding parts of the mandala in sequence. As the mental vocalization of the mantra progresses from Krishnaya to Govindaya to Gopijana Vallabhaya, the visualization of the mandala progresses concurrently from the encompassing quadrangle, Ashveta Dvipa, where Krishna manifests as the four vyuhas, Vasudeva, Sankarsana, Pradyumna, and Adivuta, to then now the lotus of Goloka, which is we're moving from the outer quadrangle now into the lotus, which is the lotus of Goloka, where he manifests as Govinda, the lord of cows. And then we go to the pericarp at the heart of the lotus, where he manifests as Gopijana Vallabha, the beloved of the gopis enthroned on the yoga pita, the center of the lotus. As the sadhaka's attention moves inward through the auditory channel, by mentally vocalizing the 18 syllable mantra that is the sonic form of Krishna, the attention simultaneously moves inward through the visual channel and arrives at the center of the lotus mandala, where the sadhaka visualizes Krishna's aniconic form as a hexagonal yantra on which the sounds of the 18 syllable mantra are visibly inscribed in letters. Finally, the sadhaka transcends the material senses altogether and awakens in samadhi to the luminous, reverberating gopa form of the absolute body, pulsating with non-material light and sound, in the yoga pita of the transcendent Vajradhamma. This synesthetic experience not only engages the non-material senses of seeing and hearing, it also engages the senses, non-material senses of taste and touch, as the sadhaka has described as savoring the sweet, exhilarating flow of rasa, ambrosial nectar in the Dhamma. Relishing the synesthetic experience in the depths of samadhi, the sadhaka surrenders at the feet of the Supreme Godhead. Svaha, I offer myself to you. Now, Jiva explicitly connects mantra meditation with visualization of a cosmographic mandala in another context in the Krishna Sandarbha, in which he invokes a passage from the Svayambhuva Agama that recommends meditation utilizing a 14-syllable mantra while meditating sequentially on the various realms of a hierarchical cosmography. While meditating on the mantra, the sadhaka is instructed to meditate in sequential order on a series of realms, which are arranged like the concentric rings of a mandala centered around Krishna, who is seated on his throne in Vrindavana. The process of visualization moves from the outermost ring of the cosmographic mandala, the material realm of Prakriti, through a series of non-material realms that are hierarchically arranged according to increasing degrees of transcendence. After meditating on the gunas of Prakriti, the sadhaka meditates on the waters of Viraja, which separate the material realm from the non-material realm. He or she then meditates sequentially on the various non-material realms, from lowest to highest, from the realm of Brahman, the abode of liberated sages, to the domain of Paravyoman, which is described in this text as the abode of the eternal devas, or gods, to the realms of the four vyuhas, Aniruddha, Pradyumna, Sankarsana, and Vasudeva. The final phase of the meditation involves a lavish visualization of the domain of Vrindavana in its transcendent splendor. Resplendent with wish-fulfilling gems, nourished by the ambrosial waters of the Yamuna, abounding in trees, vines, perpetually blooming flowers and nectarian fruits, and filled with the songs of singing birds and intoxicated bees. The meditation culminates in a visualization of the youthful form of Krishna, seated on a throne in the midst of his jewel-laden pavilion in Vrindavana, immersed in the blissful ocean of rasa that flows from his lila. Now, in the Krishna Sandarbha, Jiva recommends another kind of meditative practice, and here he calls it mantra-upasana. And it involves meditating on a particular lila in a particular place in Vrajadhaman by means of a mantra. And he introduces this meditation technique as part of his discussion of the two aspects of the unmanifest lila, what he calls the mantropasanamayi, which is a specific lila that is mentally constructed by means of meditation, utilizing mantras. And then he calls the second aspect svarasiki, which is the continuous stream of lila that is spontaneously relished as the natural flow of rasa. Now, Jiva defines mantropasanamayi more specifically as a particular lila that is constructed by meditation utilizing a particular mantra and whose distinctive identity is delimited by the particular place associated with the lila. So the place is very important in this particular meditative context or practice. He cites examples of mantras from a number of authoritative shastras that can be used in the practice of mantropasana. Verses from the Gopala Tapani Upanishad are considered particularly efficacious mantras because the Gaudiya invests this post-Vedic Vaishnava Upanishad with the transcendent authority of Shruti as the record of that which was heard and seen by the ancient rishis through their own direct experiences of Gopala Krishna in his transcendent dhamma. So Jiva then cites the following passage from the Gopala Tapani Upanishad in which Brahma the creator responds to a question by the primordial sages about the nature of Krishna's form. And Brahma then recommends meditation on a series of shlokas that describe the gopa form of Krishna engaged in a specific lila in which he's resting with his gopa and gopi companions beneath a wish-fulfilling tree near the Yamuna River in Vrajadhaman. So the place is very important in not only the description of his form, but the place. And here's the set of verses from the Gopala Tapani Upanishad. It says, "This golden one, Brahma, said, Krishna's form is in the garb of a cowherd. Is the color of a rain cloud, is youthful, and is resting under a wish-fulfilling tree. Here are the shlokas for meditation. The Lord's eyes are like lotuses. His color is that of a rain cloud. His garments are dazzling like lightning. He has two arms. His hands are positioned in the Jnana Mudra, or knowledge gesture, and he wears a garland of forest flowers. He is surrounded by gopas, gopis, and cows, is adorned with divine ornaments, and rests beneath a wish-fulfilling tree in the middle of a jeweled lotus. He is fanned by breezes that mingle with the waves of the Yamuna, and anyone who contemplates then Krishna in the heart in this way will be liberated from the cycle of birth and death." Although Jiva does not explicitly describe the specific method through which slokas such as these are utilized as mantras in meditation, he does indicate that during the practice of mantropasana, the sadhaka engages the particular lila that is the focus of the meditation through hearing, implying that the sadhaka mentally vocalizes the mantra that describes the lila while visualizing the discursive content of the mantra. Thus, for example, as the sadhaka mentally vocalizes the shlokas from the Gopala Tapani Upanishad just quoted, albeit would be in Sanskrit, he or she visualizes the particularities of Krishna's gopa form, engaging in this particular resting lila with the gopas, gopis and cows in a particular locale in Vrajadhaman. In this case, under a wish-fulfilling tree on a jeweled lotus near the Yamuna River. The regular practice of mantropasana involving visualization of a series of discrete lila tableaus, the sadhaka penetrates more and more deeply into the unmanifest structures of the lila in the transcendent dhamma and becomes increasingly immersed in the flow of rasa. In the advanced phases of raganuga bhakti, the sadhaka awakens to the constantly flowing dynamism of the svarasiki lila, in which the constructed world of lila tableaus gives way to a spontaneous stream of rasa-filled lila. And according to Jiva then, the svarasiki aspect of the unmanifest lila, in which the sadhaka relishes through direct experience a continuous stream of lila flowing with rasa, is like the Ganga River. Whereas the mantropasanamayi aspect of the lila, in which the sadhaka mentally constructs one lila after another, is like a series of pools arising from that river. Moreover, Jiva suggests that when the practice of mantropasana finds fruition in the unbroken flow of the Svarasiki Lila, then the process of hearing gives rise to true seeing, in which Krishna himself directly appears before the sadhaka in the depths of samadhi. So here's what Jiva says. He starts with a verse from the Bhagavata and then he comments. He says, this is the verse from the Bhagavata. O Lord, who are greatly praised, you become seated in the lotus of the heart, absorbed in Bhava Yoga. Your devotee's path to you is by hearing and seeing. In whatever form they contemplate you in meditation, in that form you manifest out of your greatness, graciousness. Now, Jiva's comment. He says, in accordance with this statement from the Bhagavata, when the Mantopasana Maitva finds fruition in Svarasiki, then even today, Krishna at times, again that even today, he keeps saying this, even today, Krishna at times manifests as if immediately in the hearts of sadhakas. Now, in the culminating stage of realization, in Raga Milga Bhakti, as represented by Jiva, the sadhaka goes beyond the role of a passive witness enjoying the continual play and display of Krishna's unmanifest lila and enters into the lila as an active participant and established resident of Raja Dhamam. This final stage of realization is accomplished through the attainment of a siddha rupa, perfected devotional body. Jiva's analysis suggests that just as the unmanifest lila has two aspects, the discrete lila tableaus that are mentally constructed through mantropasana, and the continuous stream of svarasiki lila that is the spontaneous expression of Krishna's blissful nature. So in the same way, the siddha rupa has two aspects. The meditative body that is mentally constructed through meditation, and the eternal non-material body that is an ansa, a portion of the self-luminous effulgence of Krishna. With respect to the first aspect, as I mentioned earlier, the Raganuga Sadaka constructs in meditation the Siddha Rupa, and these are Jiva's word, as an internal meditative body that is suitable for one's intended devotional service to Krishna. So the Siddha Rupa as an internal meditative body that is suitable for one's intended devotional service to Krishna. Under the guidance of the Guru, the Sadaka visualizes a meditative body that best expresses the rasa or devotional mode that accords with his or her unique essential nature, svarupa, and eternal body, siddharupa. The process of visualization involves identifying with those parikaras, eternal associates of Krishna, in the transcendent Vrajadhaman, who embody this particular rasa. Whether the attendants of Krishna who embody dasya rasa, the gopas who embody sakya rasa, Nanda and Yashoda who embody vatsalya rasa, or the gopis who embody madhuri rasa. The sadhaka then visualizes his or her meditative body in a series of lila tableaus, and through the agency of this meditative body envisions directly engaging with Krishna and his eternal associates in Vrajadhaman. So Jiva says, I am personally a particular resident of Vraja. I am personally attending Vrajandanandana, the son of Nanda, the lord of Vraja. Jiva's analysis suggests that regular meditation involving visualization of the mentally constructed siddha rupa serves to catalyze an awakening in which the sadhaka remembers smarana, his or her eternal siddha rupa, and reclaims his or her distinctive role as an eternal protagonist in Krishna's unmanifest lila in the transcendent Vrajadhaman. I would suggest that the critical component that distinguishes the Gaudiya methods of meditation recommended by Jiva from other types of meditation techniques advocated by yogic or tantric traditions, is meditation on, again, Krishna in his Dhamma. This distinctive emphasis is particularly evident in Jiva's discussion of archana, ritual worship, in the Bhakti Sandarbha, in which he connects meditation on Krishna in his transcendent Vrajadhaman with a cluster of tantric ritual practices derived from Pancharatra traditions. He frames this discussion by invoking two key verses from the Bhagavata Purana that discuss the relationship between Vedic and tantric traditions. Bhagavata Purana 11.27.7, which suggests that there are three systems of worshipping Krishna: Vedic, tantric, and mixed. And then Bhagavata Purana 11.3.47, which asserts that the most expedient means of severing the knot of bondage is to worship Krishna with Vedic rituals together with Tantric rituals. So following then the lead of the Bhagavata, he cites these verses, and then he suggests that the most efficacious system of worship is the mixed form that is based on the scriptural injunctions of the Brahmanical canon of Shruti and Smriti texts, the Vedas, Dharmashastras, and Puranas, together with the tantric ritual procedures of the Agamas, and more specifically, the Pancharatra Samhita. So he explicitly acknowledges that he's going to make use of the Agamas, and particularly the Pancharatra Samhitas. But then he provides what I would call a significant revisioning, of Pancharatra ritual procedures for daily worship of the deity. And the terms are, and I'll come back and describe these in a minute, but the main terms are Bhuta Shuddhi, Nyasa, and Manasa Puja. He's going to make use of these terms, but then he's going to strip away many of the tantric elements and reframe the procedures as part of a distinctively Gaudiya sadhana bhakti centered on Krishna again in his transcendent Vrajadhaman. Before I turn to Jiva's reimagining these procedures, I'd like to consider first the specific practices that constitute this ritual regimen in Pancharatra, very briefly, just so we have a sense of what's the context of the original way in which these are conceived in a Pancharatra text. And then, briefly, I want to look at the ways in which this regimen is reconfigured in the Hari Bhakti Vilasa, the authoritative Gaudiya ritual manual. And then I'll come back to Jiva to see how he really takes it even further than, I think, what the Hari Bhakti Vilasa does in terms of his revisioning. The Jayakya Samhita, which is one of the three gems of the Pancharatra canon of scriptures, provides one of the earliest and most extensive accounts in Hindu tantric literature of the initiated sadhaka's daily ritual regimen for transforming what's called the Bhautaka Sharira, the material body, into a Divya Deha, a divinized body that is qualified to offer worship to the Supreme Godhead, who's referred to in this text as Narayana or Vishnu. The daily ritual regimen, as represented in the Jayakya Samhita, includes four principal components: Bhuta Shuddhi, Nyasa, Manasa Yaga or Antra Yaga, and Bahya Yaga. So I'll briefly describe each of these. So Bhuta Shuddhi is purification of the bodily elements. And this involves an intricate process of visualization in which the sadhaka envisions the dissolution of the material body and its reconstitution as a purified and divinized body. The sadhaka, while engaging in pranayama, visualizes drawing into the body with a series of inward breaths each of the five gross elements in sequential order: earth, water, fire, air, and space. And then it dissolves each in turn into its corresponding subtle element, after which then the subtle element is expelled with an outward breath. The sadhaka then envisions burning up the material body in fire and then immersing the ashes in the ocean of milk and reconstituting a pure, luminous body that is identified with Narayana. The next stage in the process of divinizing the body is accomplished through nyasa, imposition of mantras, in which the sadhaka ritually establishes deities in various parts of the body by mentally repeating the mantra associated with each deity and touching the designated body part. Having established the deities associated with Narayana, for example, his four principal Shaktis, his avatars Nrsimha and Varaha, and the four Vyuhas, throughout the body, the sadhaka completes the process of divinization by ritually placing the seven-syllable mantra of Narayana on all parts of the body, from head to toe, and visualizing himself as fully divinized and then identified, finally, with Narayana. He says finally at the end, "I am Lord Vishnu. I am Narayana." The sadhaka then proceeds to perform Manasa Yaga or Antra Yaga, internalized mental worship, which involves an elaborate process of visualization that culminates in establishing Narayana on a lotus-borne throne in the heart and then making offerings to him mentally. The final phase in the ritual regimen is Bahya Yaga, external worship of the deity, in which the sadhaka constructs a mandala, and after installing Narayana's presence in the mandala, along with his retinue, makes offerings to him externally in the form of flowers, incense, food, and so on. This fourfold ritual regimen, Buddha Shuddhi, Nyasa, Manasa Yaga, and Bahya Yaga, is discussed in the fifth chapter of the Hari Bhakti Vilasa, which delineates the Gaudiya procedures for daily morning worship of Bhagavan. And the text itself says that these procedures, it says, this is a quote, for the most part are in accordance with the instructions of the Agamas. So it's again explicitly acknowledging its indebtedness to the Agamas, and particularly the Pancharatra Samhitas. But then we're going to see how the text in Hari Bhakti Vilasa reorients the Vishnu-oriented worship of the Vaishnava Agamas by identifying Bhagavan, the Supreme Godhead, who is the worship of, object of worship, with Krishna, of course, rather than Vishnu. The Hari Bhakti Vilasa includes a brief description of Bhuta Shuddhi, the procedures through which the sadhaka attains a purified body and becomes worthy of worshiping, offering worship to Krishna. The text invokes a passage from the Trailokya Sammohana Tantra, which describes Bhuta Shuddhi as a process of visualization involving the subtle physiology of the chakras, in which the sadhaka visualizes drying up his body and consuming it in fire, after which he envisions purifying the ashes of his incinerated corpse with amrita, the nectar of immortality, thereby transforming the body into a divinized body. And I won't read the quote, but it ends with, in this way, he should cause the body composed of the five gross elements to become divine. Now, after a brief description of pranayama, the Hari Bhakti Vilasa provides an extended exposition of nyasa. Among the various forms of nyasa that are described in the text, a particular interest for our purpose is the Keshavadi nyasa. As it is this nyasa that is explicitly mentioned by Jiva, as we'll see in the Bhakti Sandarbha. The Keshavadi nyasa involves ritually placing on the various parts of the body the varna sounds of Sanskrit, together with the names of the 51 murtis of Bhagavan, beginning with Keshava, and the names of his 51 shaktis, beginning with Kirti. The 51 murtis include, in addition to Krishna, the four vyuhas, avatars such as Varaha and Narasimha, and a variety of other manifestations of Bhagavan. The 51 shaktis that are mentioned include Lakshmi, Sarasvati, Durga, Kali, Uma, and a variety of other female powers. Although I thought it was interesting that Radha was not explicitly mentioned here in the list. The section on Keshavadi nyasa concludes with the assertion that the sadhaka who performs this nyasa attains an imperishable body comparable to that of Achyuta, the Supreme Godhead himself. This discussion of nyasas culminates in two nyasas that serve as a means of suffusing the sadhaka's entire psychophysical complex with Krishna's presence embodied in the pulsating sounds of his root mantra, the 18-syllable mantra. And one of these is called Akshara Nyasa, which involves ritually placing each of the 18 syllables of the mantra on all parts of the body. And then the second is Padanyasa, which involves placing the five parts of the 18-syllable mantra throughout the body. The Hari Bhakti Vilasa reconfigures the ritual structure of the Pancharatra regimen of daily worship by interjecting an extended account of meditation on Krishna in his transcendent Dhamman immediately prior to his discussion of Manasa Yaga. The account consists primarily of a lengthy passage from the Kramadipaka, followed by a passage from the Gotamiya Tantra. In contrast to earlier verses in which the Hari Bhakti Vilasa recommends meditation on Bhagavan in his forearm form as Vishnu, bearer of the discus, conch, club, and lotus, seated in the lotus of the heart, this Kramadipaka passage recommends meditating on Bhagavan's two-armed form as Gopala Krishna, bearer of the flute, seated on an eight-petaled lotus on his Yogapita in Vrindavana. The meditation involves a progressive series of visualizations that serve as a means of mentally constructing the domains of a mandala, Krishna's transcendent abode in Vrindavana to begin with, and then focuses in on his divine body stationed in the center of Vrindavana with a very elaborate visualization, and then it moves to his intimate associates who surround him in the inner circle, and it moves to his divine retinue in the outer circles of the mandala. By reconfiguring the Pancharatra ritual structure to include an extended meditation on Krishna in his Dhamman, The Hari Bhakta Vilasa appears to suggest that this meditation is an essential prerequisite for the Manasa Yaga or Manasa Puja that immediately follows. The sadhaka constructs in meditation a mandala with Krishna enthroned on his yoga pita in the center of Vrindavana, surrounded by his eternal associates and divine retinues. And it's this then mentally constructed mandala that provides the basis for the mental offerings of the Manasa Puja. So the Hari Bhakti Vilasa says, after meditating on Bhagavan in this way, this visualization I just mentioned, and after invoking him, one should effortlessly perform puja to him mentally with all upacharas, offerings. The text then delineates the procedure for establishing Krishna's seat within the sadhaka's own body, after which the sadhaka is instructed to perform an anta puja, an internalized puja, in which he or she mentally offers to Bhagavan, seated within the heart, the 16 upacharas that form part of the standard puja repertoire, including cloth, sandalwood paste, flowers, incense, a ghee lamp, and food offerings. The Hari Bhakti Vilasa concludes its discussion of the ritual regimen of daily morning worship of Bhagavan with extensive regulations concerning the performance of the Bahya Yaga, which it terms Bahi Puja, and reframes as external worship that's focused not on Bhagavan's aniconic form as a mandala or a yantra, but rather on his embodiment as an iconic image, murti or archa, or as the aniconic shalagrama stone. Now I'd like to turn briefly to an analysis, and we'll conclude with this, of Jiva's revisioning of the Pancharatra ritual regimen for daily worship of the deity that he develops in the Bhakti Sandarbha. It's a brief section, but I think it's a highly significant one. And this discussion appears to be based on the Hari Bhakti Vilasa's formulation of the regimen, although he doesn't explicitly cite the text there. In any case, Jiva's comments concerning this ritual regimen address a version of the regimen that's comparable to the one that's delineated in the Hari Bhakti Vilasa. And as we'll see, he reimagines this ritual procedure for daily worship in I think ways that are significantly different even from the Hari Bhakti Vilasa, in that, I mean, I think he wants to go further and reframing this practice and taking it totally outside of a tantric ritual context. So Jiva's then reformulations of the three components of daily worship that precede the external worship, the Bahi Puja, Bhuta Shuddhi, Nyasa, and Manasa Puja, are primarily aimed then at reorienting the entire worship regime from a Pancharatra form of tantric sadhana, focused on the construction of a divinized tantric body that is identified with the deity. He wants to move it away from that to a Gaudiya form of sadhana bhakti, focused on the fashioning of a perfected devotional body that is eternally distinct from, while at the same time in relationship with, of course internal relationship with, the divine body of Bhagavan and Vrajadaman. So in this context then, Jiva's revisioning I think goes further than that of the Hari Bhakti Vilasa. At the outset, Jiva provides a devotional framework for his discussion by stating that his concern will be to present the procedures that pure bhaktas are to follow in daily worship. He says, I will now explain to the best of my ability, Bhuta Shuddhi, etc., pertaining to pure bhaktas. He recasts the entire purpose of Bhuta Shuddhi, purification of the material body, by explicitly asserting that the true bhakta does not seek to divinize the body by identifying with the body of Krishna, for such a practice would be tantamount to ahangropasana, worship of oneself as identical with the Lord. In contrast to the Hari Bhakti Vilasa, he avoids the language of divinization and any mention of the subtle physiology, and he reframes Bhuta Shuddhi as a distinctively Gaudiya practice in which the bhakta contemplates the body not in the form of Krishna himself, but rather in the form of an eternal associate, Parikara or Parshada, who resides with Krishna in his transcendent Vrajadaman, who embodies a particular rasa or devotional mode. In this way, the practice of Bhuta Shuddhi serves as a method through which an advanced practitioner of Raganuga Bhakti can realize the particular rasa that accords with his or her svarupa, unique inherent nature. So I want to read a section of this. I think this language is very important. He says, so those whose sole goal is devotional service to the Lord should perform Bhuta Shuddhi up to the point of contemplation of one's body as that of his eternal... Those whose sole goal is devotional service to the Lord should perform Bhuta Shuddhi up to the point of contemplation of one's body as that of his eternal associate, which leads to the realization of the mode of devotional service to Bhagavan that accords with one's inherent nature. Thus, wherever it is enjoined that one should think of oneself in the form of one's own beloved deity, one should instead contemplate oneself assuming the form of an eternal associate, because pure bhaktas abhor worship of oneself as identical with the Lord. In the latter case, one's identity with an eternal associate is in an analogous sense only, since the bodies of the eternal associates are composed of Vishuddha Sattva, pure luminous being, which is an aspect of the Lord's Chit Shakti. In his reformulation of the practice of Bhuta Shuddhi, Jiva is thus careful to emphasize that the bhakta's body does not in actuality become identified with the body of an eternal associate, for the eternal associates are nitya siddhas, eternally perfected beings, whose bodies are composed of shuddha sattva, pure, luminous being, whereas ordinary bhaktas are sadhakas, practitioners of sadhana bhakti, whose bodies are composed of prakriti, matter, and who have not yet realized their siddha rupas, perfected non-material bodies. For example, if the bhakta's inherent nature is that of a gopi, then he or she will visualize the body in the form of a gopi and will seek to identify with the devotional mode, but not the actual bodies of the nitya siddha gopis who reside perpetually with Krishna in Vrajadaman and who are paradigmatic exemplars of Madhurya Rasa. Jiva suggests that this process of identifying with the devotional mode of an eternal associate in Vrajadaman serves as a means of purifying the bhakta's material body through gradually imbibing the pure nature of the nitya siddha. With respect to nyasa, Jiva explicitly mentions the Keshavadi nyasa, which, as discussed earlier, is one of the key nyasas described in the Hari Bhakti Vilasa, and involves ritually establishing the 51 murtis of Bhagavan together with his 51 shaktis in various parts of the body. Jiva's brief description reaffirms the basic procedure of mentally repeating the mantra associated with each deity and touching the designated body part. However, in contrast to the Hari Bhakti Vilasa, which considers the entire body to have been purified through Bhuta Shuddhi, and therefore does not object to establishing the deity in all parts of the bhakta's body, including body parts such as the feet or anus that are deemed impure in the Brahmanical hierarchy of purity. In contrast to that, Jiva is insisting that it's inappropriate for the bhakta to visualize the deity becoming established in the lowest parts of the body. So he says, with respect to the Keshavadi nyasa and other nyasas, whenever the nyasa is focused on the lowest parts of the body, one should meditate on the specific murti, mentally repeat the corresponding mantra, and then simply touch that particular part of the body. However, one should not meditate on the deity of the mantra becoming established in that part of the body, because that would be inappropriate for bhaktas. Like the Hari Bhakti Vilasa, Jiva connects Manasa Puja with meditation on Krishna in his transcendent dhamma. And as I mentioned earlier, the Hari Bhakti Vilasa suggests that meditation on Krishna in his dhamma is a prerequisite for Manasa Puja, in which the sadhaka then makes mental offerings to Krishna seated within the heart. But Jiva goes even further than the Hari Bhakti Vilasa, because he asserts first that the meditation of true bhaktas should focus on Krishna in the lotus of the transcendent dhamma, Goloka Vrindavana, not in the lotus of the heart. And second, that Manasa Puja should also involve contemplation of Krishna exclusively in his dhamma, implying that the process of mentally offering upacharas to him should be envisioned as taking place in Vrajadhamma rather than in the heart. And here's what he says. Whereas the meditation of the yogins is on the Lord stationed in the lotus of the heart, the principal meditation for bhaktas is on Bhagavan stationed in his dhamma, in accordance with the declaration that one should meditate on him and beautiful Vrindavana. Thus, Manasa Puja involves contemplation of him exclusively in his dhamma. In the case of meditation on the Kama Gayatri Mantra, which makes reference to the Lord in the orb of the sun, this meditation also involves contemplation of him exclusively in his Dhamman. Thus it is declared in the Brahma Samhita, he who is the self of all resides in Goloka, exclusively in Goloka, with an emphasis on the particle Eva, exclusively. So he's making a fairly strong point here, I think, with this, especially with this emphasis on Eva, exclusively. So Jiva further emphasizes that even when the bhakta is residing in other places outside of the earthly Vrindavana, he or she should manifest the Dhamman in meditation and contemplate Bhagavan residing there. This manasa puja should also include meditation on Krishna, engage with his eternal associates in various lila activities in his Dhamman. Moreover, Jiva maintains that the ultimate fruit of this meditation is not a mental fabrication of an imaginary world, but an actual cognition in samadhi of reality as it is, yatartha, in which the bhakta attains a direct visionary experience of the unmanifest lila that unfolds eternally in the transcendent Vraja Dhamman, Goloka Vrindavana, beyond the material realm. Jiva suggests that during manasa puja or anta puja, internalized mental worship, the divine body and the bhakta's body interpenetrate one another, with the Lord entering into the limbs of the bhakta and the bhakta becoming immersed in the effulgence of the divine body. However, he emphasizes that it is important for the bhakta to always maintain an awareness of the distinction between the divine body and the human body in order to, again, avoid the abhorrent practice of ahangropasana, worship of oneself as identical with the Lord. So, for example, when worshipping Krishna's flute as part of the manasa puja, the bhakta is instructed to contemplate the flute in Krishna's mouth, not in his or her own mouth. Even when displaying the bodily gesture called Venu Mudra, which involves making the gesture of holding Krishna's flute to the mouth, the bhakta is cautioned to always maintain an awareness of the flute in relation to the body of Bhagavan in order to avoid lapsing into ahangra upasana. So here's what he says. With respect to the worship of the flute, etc., that forms part of the anta puja involving external upacharas, the bhakta, whose limbs are immersed in the effulgence of the Lord's body and in into whose limbs the Lord has entered, should contemplate the flute in the Lord's mouth and not in his own mouth. The display of mudras involving the Lord's ornaments, such as the flute, for example, holding the flute to one's own mouth, should be done only for the purpose of showing him the various articles that are dear to him. However, one should not contemplate these articles as placed on one's own limbs for the reason previously stated. Angropasana. In his revisioning, then, of Bhuta Shuddhi, Nyasa, and Manasa Puja as parts of Sadhana Bhakti, Jiva presents these internalized practices as components as a process of psychophysical transformation that is based on a model of embodiment that diverges in quite significant ways from the Pancharatra model. So what does the Pancharatra model do? I'm just summing up now to remind you of where it's going, I think, in terms of I'm interested in embodiment. You see the language of bodies coming in there quite a bit. But the Pancharatra model of embodiment that's articulated in the Jayakya Samhita that I mentioned earlier, like other tantric discourses, gives priority to the human body as the locus of divine embodiment and represents the process of transformation as a three-stage process. In the first stage, Bhuta Shuddhi, the sadhaka visualizes the dissolution of the material body and the reconstitution of a pure, luminous body that is identified with the divine body of Narayana. In the second stage, Nyasa, the sadhaka further divinizes the body by installing divine powers throughout the psychophysiology and visualizing the body as fully identified with Narayana. In the third stage, Manasa Yaga, the sadhaka establishes the divine body of Narayana in the heart of the divinized human body, which provides then the locus for the series of mental offerings. The Gaudiya discourse of embodiment, articulated by Jiva, in contrast, gives priority to the transcendent Dhamman as the locus of divine embodiment, not the human body, He's always shifting away from there. It's the transcendent Dhamma, then, is the locus of divine embodiment. And then he recasts then the three-stage process of transformation within a devotional framework. In the first stage, Bhuta Shuddhi, the bhakta purifies the material body by contemplating the body in the form of an eternal associate of Krishna in its transcendent Dhamma, Raja Dhamma, thereby investing the body with the pure nature of the eternal associate. In the second stage, Nyasa, the bhakta further purifies the body by establishing forms of Krishna in various parts of the body and thereby investing the psychophysiology with the qualities of the divine body. In the third stage, Manasa Puja, the bhakta meditates on Krishna in his transcendent Dhamma and immerses the body in the pure effulgence of the divine body, or the absolute body of Bhagavan, thereby bringing the process of purification to fruition. The ultimate goal, as formulated by Jiva, is not to attain a divya deha, divinized body, that is identified with Krishna, but rather to realize a siddha deha, or siddha rupa, a perfected, non-material body that is like Bhagavan. And he uses the term Bhagavat tulyatva. It is like Bhagavan. It is not identified with Bhagavan. In that, it is an ansha of the divine effulgence, and it partakes of the qualities and substance of the absolute body. But the siddha rupa always retains its distinct identity as a devotional body, eternally engaged in a relationship of difference in non-difference, bhedha bhedha, with Bhagavan in the transcendent Vajradhamma. So I'll end there.
Thank you, Barbara.
Well,
I think we've been taken on quite a tour de force of Jiva Goswami's teachings, Raga Nuga, and I personally am very illuminated by this. It makes me want to run to Vrindavan just do it.
Manifested in your mind, if you can.
Sorry?
Just manifest it in your mind.
Yes. Some questions come to my mind, but that should be an opportunity first for everyone here. Any questions?
Kiel.
Yes.
Thank you very much for this very exciting presentation. Yes, my question in short is, where do you think Jiva is getting this revision, the idea of revising the transcendental tradition? Do you see any possible influence from either Sri Sampradaya or Madhava Sampradaya? The reason I ask this is because in terms of metaphysics and anthropology, the Jiva is very much close to Sri Sampradaya.
Right.
And for example, this discussion of relationship between Sri and Vishnu, this idea is very much based on Sanskritic tradition, which comes through Sri Sampradaya, particularly Parashara. But in this particular, so that shows Jiva is very much familiar with Sanskritic tradition. But at the same time here, in this particular topic we discussed, is very much emphasizing duality, the distinction between Sarva and the Lord. So I'm just wondering, is can we see this in Sri Sampradaya ritual procedure or not or somewhere?
Yeah, you know, it's a very good question. And I have not looked at the Sri Vaishnava adaptation of this particular ritual, which is a very good place to go. I have been interested, in my book, I have a chapter on different modalities of divine embodiment and the very complex hierarchy of divine forms of Krishna. Right, all the different forms of avatars and vyuhas and the vilasas, and I have a whole chart. I can pass that. I try to even more complicated than Tony Stewart's chart in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Yeah, I
I felt it needed a revision. But, so I've been very interested in the relationship between the Sri Vaishnavas and the Gaudiyas. And at one point I was thinking about the way in which the Sri Vaishnavas talk about the five forms of the divine auspicious vigraha of Vishnu. And after I had kind of mapped out in detail this kind of hierarchy of divine forms elaborated by Rupa Goswami, and particularly then as commented on, elaborated by Krishnadas Kaviraj. I deal with different texts and different chapters. Then I came back and said, okay, let's look at this in relationship to the Sri Vaishnava model, and is this just an adaptation of that? And, and there definitely are parallels, but at every point I really see the Gaudiyas as actually going beyond the Sri Vaishnavas. And especially, for example, in the proliferation of divine forms, their notion of avatars, the complex, multi-layered hierarchy of avatars, development of the notion of viewers with operating on multiple levels. I mean, again, there are ways in which they overlap, but I do think that Rupa, Jiva, and Krishnadasa, those are the ones I'm really focusing on, really take it further than the Sri Vaishnavas. I would be interested to go to this particular procedure and see what's happening there. But I think there's a very distinctive Gaudiya framing here. I think the Vrajadaman part is what gives it the distinctively Gaudiya flavor. Even if you go to the Sri Vaishnavas, again, and of course, the Sri Vaishnavas have a notion of the transcendent abode of Vishnu, and he has eternal associates, and you could say there are definitely parallels there. But I think that when you get into the details of what is Vrajadaman, the way in which the Goswamis elaborate on this, I have a 100-page chapter on Vraja, which I excerpted a very small piece of for his volume. But I think they're going further. I think there are overlaps, but I don't think that they're just borrowing wholesale. And I'm not sure, of course we know that Jiva is, as you say, citing Madhva, citing Ramanuja in the Sandarbhas frequently. But it's not completely clear. It's not completely clear which text he's making use of, right? And how much these are filtered through other sources. I mean, Madhva maybe directly, but there's other, like even his sources, Puranic sources, sometimes filtered through Madhva. So it's just I think it's an important question. I think it's something I would have to look into for this particular procedure. But I would say that my main sense is, from my overall take on this, at least the book that I've just recently finished, I think that the Gaudiyas are actually doing something that overlaps but is actually distinctly different. I think that they develop a kind of much more complex notion of modalities of human embodiment in the Dhamman, which the Vaishnavas don't really have that idea, that Krishna becomes embodied in a place, and that you have the notion that, and this is in Jiva, that the Vrajadaman, that the local place is a form of his body. And the idea of course, the Archa Vigraha, the idea of the Archa Avatar, that's in the Sri Vaishnavas. But in fact, I think the Gaudiyas go further in developing other modalities of embodiment that you don't see in the Vaishnavas. So I think particularly with this, the Vrajadaman piece of it, which is so distinctive in this meditative practice, I think that's quite distinctive. That's at least my hunch so far. That's a good question. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
Very refreshing. And I liked also the way how you go about some aspects of the tradition which connect to yoga, especially because in culture, in academics, it seems that the concept of meditation, as you mentioned, and the mangalas are normally mentioned in relation to maybe Buddhism or classical yoga, but this has established and developed system in the Gaudiya tradition. It's very exciting to bring up more. My question is, I like when you brought up the connection or the relation with Ashtanga Yoga, then you mentioned the Sampragata Samadhi. It seems like in the classical yoga system, there is a tendency to put a theistic emphasis on it. So But my question here would be, do you find that there are other parallel systems within the Bhakti traditions which are especially focused on the personal aspect in ways which are maybe parallel to the Gaudiyas in that sense?
Within Bhakti traditions?
Yeah, within the at large. If this emphasis on meditation, on the ultimate goal as a personal aspect of the Supreme is equally strong in other traditions besides Gaudiya.
You know, I have an article that I keep holding on to because it's sort of trying to do something big, which is trying to make sense out of, you know, what is at the heart of these various things, traditions we call bhakti traditions. I mean, you know, are there things that hold together the multiplicity of bhakti traditions? And I actually think that one of the most important aspects of bhakti traditions, broadly conceived, is the focus on the personal. I think that's what distinguishes bhakti traditions. I mean, the idea of, I mean, bhakti is from the root bhaj, to share, to partake of. And I think it has to do with relationship. I mean, if we want to kind of come back, what is it basically? Well, people translate as devotion. But it's about it developing an intimate, loving, you could say devotional, relationship with the deity conceived as other. And there, the distinction between the bhakta as subject and the divine object of devotion is the starting point for devotion. There has to be a distinction. Now, the goal in different traditions is to overcome that distinction in some kind of union. Some traditions, like certain Ram traditions, will actually emphasize that they want to merge with Ram in a kind of sayuja, sort of merging, being absorbed into Rama, where the distinction between the bhakta and Ram will be actually ultimately overcome. But they also emphasize you have to start with the distinction. Because otherwise there's no love, there's no place for the relationship. One can't develop a relationship with an it. And I think that's one of the most fundamental aspects of most bhakti traditions that would distinguish bhakti traditions from, say, certain kinds of tantra traditions, ascetic traditions, yogic traditions, you know, a range of different traditions. Certain yogic traditions that talk about realizing the ultimate reality as some kind of an it. You know, I want to realize my identity with my identity as a self or as Atman, Brahman, as an it. It's impersonal and can have bhakti there. I think that's a starting point. Now again, the type of union will be different from tradition to tradition, and some will not end up with beta. They will end up with pure merging. But I think the starting point of difference is always there. I mean, that's my claim. I haven't released the article yet, but I think I'm pretty solid ground. Let's see.
Although officially our time is up, I feel like taking the liberty, since I gave a lot of time after my
so I'm going to take that time and we're going to transfer it to this.
You mentioned, Barbara, that in the practice that Jiva describes, you use the word construction, I think, in regard to meditating on one's form, that one eventually wants to, I don't know how it's exactly put, and that's kind of my question, one wants to be ultimately one's swarupa. But construction suggests sort of putting something together. Now, my question is, at one point you also said that one should be meditating on a form which is in conformity with, or I forgot the word you used, one's svarupa. And then it seems to me a sort of typical question might be, right, so but how do I know what's my svarupa? And probably the answer is, well, your guru knows, so he's going to tell you what. She's going to tell you. And so, in this way, you get going. I know that a later acharya of our tradition, Bhakti Noah, seems to almost modernize this whole process by suggesting that the guru and the disciple may kind of together discuss and work out, rather than the guru telling, this is now how you should meditate. It's more of a back and forth. Well, I kind of like that idea, but I kind of don't like that idea, says the shishya. I really prefer to, you know, meditate with Amigopa rather than Gopi or vice versa or whatever. I'm just wondering if jiva is articulating awareness to what to me seems like a kind of catch 22. How do you get started? Is he explicitly saying this problem is solved in the guru, or is he saying explicitly?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny, I had this thought, I thought someone's going to ask me that question. I'm going to tell you. Yeah, well, it's ambiguous, actually. I mean, I mentioned the guru. I think I slipped the guru in there. But he doesn't talk a lot about it. I mean, he doesn't. I mean, but let me come back to one thing before I come to the guru issue. Maybe I didn't make this clear, but what I found was really interesting in the notion of Siddha Rupa. Siddha Rupa he uses in two different ways. One is as what he calls the meditative body, and he talks about that one visualizes in meditation, and he calls it antaschintata deha. So it's a a body that one mentally constructs through meditation. He uses that kind of language as a way to catalyze remembrance of the eternal Siddha Rupa. So he uses it in both ways, right? It's a practice that one. So if one is one's Siddha Rupa is that of a gopi, and one's essential nature is Svarupa, and Siddha Rupa is that of a gopi. And he does talk about gopi, not Manjari, right? This is, I mean, the earliest. I know later on there's Manjari Sadhana, but Jiva doesn't talk about that. He talks about that one could be a gopi or a gopa. So let's say one's Siddha Rupa is that of a gopi. And again, how one knows that, he doesn't talk about it. He doesn't talk about it. But let's say, whether through the guru or one's own internal stage of realization, one comes to have a sense of that. The idea would be to meditate, to construct a meditation, meaning to visualize, when I say construct, visualize a meditation, oneself as a gopi, inserting oneself into what he calls these constructed, I use the term constructed, lila tableaus, that one visualizes Krishna with these shlokas, Krishna next to this tree, in this place, in Vrindavana, in this particular lila, and then, you know, initially one just constructs the lila tableaus mentally, and then eventually that'll catalyze the spontaneous flow of svarasiki lila, where it'll spontaneously then be manifesting before one. But the visualization practice is a way to catalyze the spontaneous realization of svarasiki lila. Same way, the mental construction of the siddha rupa, visualizing oneself and inserting oneself into the lila tableau as a gopi, say, and doing that regularly is supposed to catalyze smarana, the remembrance of the eternal Siddha Rupa. So he uses it in both ways, right? That the finally, it is eternal non-material body. You're not constructing the eternal body. It's already there. You're constructing a meditative body as it basically just a technique to help remember and catalyze realization of what already exists. So he certainly talks about it in both senses. And I tried to set up that parallel, I think, between mantra-upasana, again, where you're constructing these lila tableaus in meditation, and then when it finally becomes a stage of realization. That, I think, is a parallel to the idea of a mentally constructed siddha-rupa, which leads to realization of an eternal siddha-rupa that exists, is there. And one has to just awaken, remember. But what's fascinating to me is he doesn't, you know, it's very elliptical. I mean, he talks about these things, but, you know, I mean, as I told you explicitly a few places, well, he doesn't explicitly say this, so I'm gonna, you know, I did a little bit of reconstruction. And, you know, I may be wrong. I mean, I don't know, you know, a few places. But the mantra-upasana, svarasiki, he's pretty clear about what he's doing there, but he doesn't go so far as to say, how does one know what one's. He just always says, again and again, one constructs a meditative, or has a meditative body that suits one's intended devotional service. And whatever that, you know, one's svarupa. And one emulates an eternal associate that accords with one's svarupa. assuming that somehow...
There is the rub.
But you know, as some of you who are probably familiar with David Hamerman's, now you know you are, acting as a way of salvation, he deals with this, the later debates, because there are later, a lot of debates in the later Gaudiya tradition, right, about the role of the guru, whether it should be through the guru, or whether it's not through the guru. I mean, my sense is, but I mean, I have not researched this in all the later layers of the tradition, my sense is that the guru was the critical. I mean, it was critical here, because the guru, at least in certain streams of Gaudiya thought, the guru is the one who's in the stage of realization, who's already enjoying the transcendent Vrajadhamana, according to, at least, this is a realized guru, then that guru can see the disciple and see the disciple's siddha-rupa and then guide the disciple to the proper practice. I mean, my sense, I don't know. I mean, I don't know why there were so many debates later about whether that was appropriate, but I think that certainly was a dominant stream. I don't see Jiva explicitly acknowledging it, but I haven't canvassed every bit of all the Sandarbhas. I've been focusing mainly on the Krishna Sandarbha in this particular, and Bhakti Sandarbha for this particular aspect. So, it's a question. It is a big question. I know it's an important question. Yeah.
I think we'll have to leave that question. Okay. But thank you so much. This was quite an amazing presentation.
Well, thank you.